Hello and welcome to season 3 of On My Last Eggs. I'm Rachel, and like millions of other women worldwide, I'm navigating the wild throes of perimenopause.
You know, every day somebody sends me an email or an Instagram or whatever and says, oh, I've decided not to kill my dog because I've realised I've got perimenopause. And you think, another dog saved.
I'll be lifting the lid on what that whole messy, confusing journey entails, with plenty of lols and some WTFs along the way.
I threw against the kitchen wall blue poster paint, an entire butternut squash, and a copy of Nigella's Christmas at different times.
I was going to say, that wasn't all on one day, was it? Very excited to welcome my next guest on My Last Eggs. Kate Muir is a writer, film critic, documentary maker. She's published 3 novels, and last year her book, Everything You Need to Know About the Menopause But Were Too Afraid to Ask, was published. She's the creator and producer of 2 documentaries on the menopause, including Davina McCall, Sex, Myths and the Menopause for Channel 4. She's an activist for the menopause charity, and she's an all-round badass, so I'm very excited to welcome to On My Last Eggs. Kate, hello.
Thank you. Always ready to cause trouble if you need some.
Well, do you know what? I feel like we should start with that immediately. I do love that you've become a very gentle, intelligent troublemaker around menopause.
Well, there is so much to be said and so much going wrong and such simple solutions to the disaster of menopause. And I'm just so aware we could change things in a year or two, certainly in the UK. And also, I've read a lot of the science, so I really know what works, what doesn't work, what's fake. And I'm kind of aware from doctors of what they know and what they're not being taught. And I think we could just make a couple of leaps forward and there'd be huge change. And, you know, like doing a book and doing these documentaries, you know, every day somebody sends me an email or an Instagram or whatever and says, oh, I've decided not to kill my dog because I've realized I've got perimenopause. And you think, another dog saved, you know, but there is that kind of every day it's worthwhile. And every day when you get up and think, oh, I don't want to talk about menopause again, I've done that. And then you think, oh, but, you know, you can make a difference. And I suppose it's been the nicest job I've ever had in that sense, because it is life-changing for me and for other people and for all of us in the menopause movement.
So let me ask you about your menopause journey. Did it sneak up on you by stealth like it seems to for most of us?
Can I say we mustn't use the word journey?
Why not?
Case, we must use the word car crash. So I did a full Thelma and Louise off the cliff. I had a terrible menopause, perimenopause. I had heart palpitations, thought I was going mad, went to the doctor, got an ECG, was waking up at 4 in the morning with my heart doing that kind of cartoon thing pumping out of my body. And I didn't know what was wrong with me. And I was running and I was, you know, and they said, oh, you need to stop drinking so much coffee. And I thought, this is wrong. And then my memory went. I was the film critic at the Times. And I was writing a shopping list one Saturday and I thought, must shave my legs, wrote down the word shaver. And then I thought, there is definitely another word for that thing, but I can't remember it. And I was horrified because I'd occasionally forgotten the name of a film or something because there were so many, but this was a noun, a domestic noun. And my mum had died of Alzheimer's, you know, the year before that. And I'd seen her losing nouns over 10 years. So I was aware exactly how a brain disintegrated. And I just thought I had Alzheimer's, rang all my friends panicking. And they all said, oh, we all went and got HRT privately, but we haven't discussed it with one another. I'm like, you could have told me this down the pub. And, you know, as soon as I got HRT, it was a miracle, literally, for me within days in terms of hot flushes and heart palpitations. And they never came back. And my memory really improved. So it was such a shock because I thought I was quite a smart journalist and I could look up everything and I would, you know, be able to research everything. And this was like 6 years ago. And there wasn't that much to research in a way that now you would find out that heart palpitations were part of the perimenopause and that you weren't, you know, going to die in the night.
You're right. Now it would be very easy with a very quick Google, wouldn't it, to find out that that's likely to be perimenopause. I want to ask you about the Davina documentary. I want to ask you like this, like if we were down a pub, like, so what came first? Did you have the idea for the documentary, then think Davina would be the person for it? Was Davina looking for a menopause documentary? Was I'm kind of curious to know how all this works.
No, I came up with the idea for the documentary and I took it to a number of channels who turned it down and a number of production companies. So we had three or four failed attempts. Then we got it commissioned, and then with Channel 4, and then lockdown happened and the entire documentary was cancelled. All the money was taken back, at which point we didn't have a presenter and we didn't have a documentary. And because I was trapped home alone for all that time, it was really good actually, because it made me write the book about the menopause and ring scientists at Yale and Harvard who were trapped in their back bedrooms, you know, during that lockdown, desperate not to make any more sourdough bread and quite keen to answer questions. So I got this
I love the
amazing
idea of scientists. Just don't
access.
make me make any more banana loaf.
Exactly. So I got this amazing access, which I don't think I would have got very quickly, to the big brains on menopause around the whole world. And I interviewed them all. I just went through the whole lot and they all recommended other people. And so by the time we came back to try and, you know, punch through the documentary again, a friend of mine, Lorraine Candy, who does postcards for midlife, said, "Oh, Davina, you know, she might be interested in that. Maybe you should try her." And I rang her up thinking, no idea. And I said, "Here's my menopause story." She said, "Here's my menopause story." And we had an hour-long conversation. And then I knew she was the one. And also she was quite brave because, you know, it's about her having menopause at 44. It was very much destroying a certain part of her image by saying, "I am an older woman and I am no longer fertile." And, you know, there is that sort of culture of shock around people being brave enough to say that, though they shouldn't be. Anyway, she didn't and ah. She just said, "Right, I feel I have to do this." And she took a punt on it, and we all took a punt on it. And I remember the first night we weren't sure if anyone was going to watch it, and a million women watched it, or people watched it. And then by the Friday after, 2 million had watched it because there was the catch-up TV. And now nearly 6 million women have watched the two documentaries, which is most of the menopausal women in the. I'm sure there are couples too, and there's probably trans and non-binary people who've watched it, but anyway, we've cracked into a large percent of the audience. And I was very keen, you know, not just to talk to a menopause so white elite, which we know exists. And it's always worth if you can make something that will be have a really broad appeal, which is what we tried to do with that. And we had some great participants like Karen Arthur, who runs Menopause Whilst Black, who is just fantastic. And, you know, she really rocks it as part of the show.
Oh yeah, well you've definitely pulled a fantastic program together, and I love that little bit of sort of magic timing of, you know, Davina sounds like she was always ready to burst with her story once you spoke together, which is interesting because I'm absolutely 100% sure that a Spice Girl must be menopausal by now, right? And I'm just waiting for the right time to try and get one on the show.
Oh, we should get the whole lot,
Oh
shouldn't
my
we?
God, yeah, I don't would
Oh,
I can't imagine Posh ever admitting that she's menopausal.
yeah. I don't know. That's a way forward. I like it. I
Okay, yeah,
like
I'm thinking, you know, the Spice Girls have come of
it.
age, you
Yeah,
know, that's
that
something,
would
isn't it?
be fantastic.
So you mentioned at the beginning of this that you feel that there's a whole bunch of things that could be just sorted out in a year. And I really like that idea. I mean, one thing I was going to say I've been campaigning for, but sadly all I can my only campaigning is making this podcast and, you know, piffling on a bit. But I absolutely think all women should get a letter at 45, maybe 40, maybe redressing that. Just saying, these are the list of symptoms you might well be getting. If you're worried about anything, call your doctor. You don't have to call them in for a test or anything, just a letter, just a flyer. I think that could be done overnight, really simple.
I totally agree. I think even more simply, cheaper, no postage. They come into the doctor's surgery. You can have an electronic download or a piece of paper which you print out with your 20 menopause symptoms. And everybody who's 40 something, you know, ticks them as they go in. And
Perfect.
it could be something about their thyroid, it could be something entirely different. But it gives women a chance to do that. And it gives doctors a chance to look at vaginal dryness, point number seven, you know, that nobody would have brought up.
It also might help medical science a little bit because we're so unresearched. It's like an opportunity to actually look into women's health.
Yeah. And so, I mean, yes, a list of symptoms to women would be fantastic. A menopause leaflet or poster in a doctor's surgery would be fantastic. Mine certainly doesn't have it yet in many languages, and those posters are available, in Urdu, in Punjabi, all sorts of things. But yet, that would be really simple and really cheap too. So those first two things are almost free, aren't they? Asking doctors, if possible, to watch the Confidence in the Menopause course, which 30,000, I think, doctors have now done, which is put out by the Menopause Charity and 14 Fish, and just, helping those older doctors understand the latest news about HRT. And the younger generation are fantastic, I generally find, and they're very keen to learn and do extra modules on it. But because it's not part of the curriculum of a separate module for the Royal College of GPs, it's not perhaps taken as seriously as it should be. And the really, really stupid thing about that, I think, is that what has got to be made really, really clear to women and to doctors is that HRT is not the same. There are two different kinds, and we know that. But lots and lots of women don't. And there is the old HRT, which is synthetic, and the one that, was in the Women's Health study in over 20 years ago, actually. And the stuff we use now, which is body identical, which is from soy, which is a copy of your own hormones, and which in big observational studies is showing no increased risk of breast cancer. So we've got this great stuff, and we've got this not so good stuff. And we're still giving the not so good stuff to women in economically deprived areas or women who don't know what to ask for. And I just think, why are we giving a huge chunk of Britain suboptimal HRT when we could give them the decent stuff like estrogel, the transdermal estrogen gel, which actually costs much the same? It's not like it's some massive saving. It's just sloppy work. And you could just change the formulae, make a national formulae, and say, here are the top safest HRTs here. Why don't you look at them first? And that is only someone going to a computer and changing it, I mean, they're very small things to ask, but there's a great big kind of fat burg of bureaucracy in the way. And I don't know how to deal with that apart from kind of go around it and help women to inform themselves.
Well, you're doing a good job. You're doing a good job scraping your way over and around the fatberg of bureaucracy. I've got an image,
Yeah.
in my head there, Kate. That little chat with Kate Muir about the Spice Girls has got me thinking, actually. I mean, who would they be now? I mean, they wouldn't be baby and sporty anymore, would they? I mean, they'd be like angry Spice, sweaty Spice, moody Spice. Atrophy Spice, Anxiety Spice. The list is endless. At least 34 different kinds of Spice Girls could come about from menopause. But what would they sound like now? I mean, if they were to rework some of their old songs, like, I don't know, Wannabe, for instance, how would it be changed as we've got Spice Girls in midlife? I wonder, eh? I wonder. Oh, tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I'll tell you what I really, really want. I really want 5 hours sleep. That's all. That's all I'm asking for, really. I mean, I don't know. If you want to be my lover, you gotta bring lots of lube. Cause sex just ain't that easy, and I'm never in the mood. If you want to be my lover, you have got to know. I can sweat 10 litres before the night is through. Tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I'll tell you what I want, what I really, really want. Oh, go on, tell me what you want, what you really, really want. I just want 5 hours sleep. That's all. Oh, I feel like the Spice Girls are in the room now, probably suffering from brain fog, night sweat, itchy vaginas, the works. Oh, it's beautiful to bring the middle-aged Spice Girls to life, right? Right, enough Spice Girl shenanigans. Let's go back to Kate Muir. Let's talk about testosterone, if I might, because that's also something I know that you're very vocal about. At the minute, it's a bit of a lottery. It's not really available to many women, but it can be available only on the grounds of complete loss of libido. They won't give it to you on the grounds of anything else. However, we know that testosterone, I mean, you mentioned memory loss and brain fog, and I'm the same. I'm literally 50% down on nouns. I mean, there's just so much pointing goes on in my life now. So testosterone, in all your research, why should we be having it?
It's my favourite subject now. And I think it is the great piece of gender bias in this story. And once the research is done and dug up, it is going to be fascinating to see what rises up on testosterone. So obviously the first thing is the NICE guidelines say we can prescribe that if you kind of go to a specialist usually for libido. And so we are kind of couching ourselves in terms of male sexual pleasure in some sort of way. I mean, I know libido might be, but it seems to be a very old fashioned expectation that that would be the only reason we would want testosterone. Now, the big expert on testosterone who I interviewed is called Professor Susan Davis, and she is an Australian, used to head the International Menopause Society. And she again says, not all women need it. Yes, it does help with libido. All the papers and things have shown it helps with libido. And it is not really on the whole going to make your voice grow deeper or make you grow an enormous clitoris. Or, you know, you might get a little bit of bodily hair. But really,
by the way, can I say, I would not be unhappy with a bigger clitoris. I don't know many other clitorises, but I feel quite happily endowed. But I mean, who's going to complain about a bigger clitoris?
Really? Well, absolutely. And also, many people's clitorises shrink in menopause.
Exactly.
But that really does not happen unless women are using the wrong amount or absorb it in an extraordinary way. And if they are using the right amount, which is the same as they had in their 40s, they are not going to turn into hairy bears. And so it's very, very silly. And the idea that this has been the biggest hormone we've made in our bodies all our lives, we've made most of, it's our cardinal hormone, and that it has not been considered a female hormone, and that men have fenced it off from us and said, this is our hormone. I mean, it is reasonable to expect that what testosterone is doing in men in terms of muscle mass, bone, energy, cognitive performance, all those things, it is very likely to be doing a similar thing in the female body. And one of the other studies done by Susan Davis in Australia was in 2011 and 2014, she studied testosterone in a small group of women. I think it was very small, the first group. They had HRT and they got a top up of testosterone, and all of them showed improvement in memory over, I think it was less than 6 months. And then again, they did the same study just with testosterone alone and no HRT. Yet again, those women showed an improvement in memory. And there's a kind of shopping list test where you kind of are given a list and then you have to remember it like 5 minutes later. So in these small scale studies, and they are randomized controlled trials, so they're not nothing. They're not just observational. And we have numbers on how many things on the shopping list the women could remember. So it is quantifiable. It did improve memory. Now, what interests me is why we aren't joyous about that. And why, and I'm asking you here, why are we not talking about the hope that is around testosterone?
Well, it's a good question. I think going back to the hairy bear, I think there is a fear, same as there is still a fear about breast cancer and HRT, which we know, you know, is an outdated fear if you're on the right kind of HRT. You say the word testosterone to women and they think, well, that's going to make changes to me that I don't want and that might be irreversible and are negative. I think you're right that it's been ring fenced as a male thing. And I think part of the problem is, like all the things to do with women's health, it just hasn't been researched enough, you know, and forget menopause. Do we even know what testosterone is doing the rest of the time for us? Is it working differently for women as it is for men? You know, what's it doing in a 13-year-old girl when you're going through puberty? You know, we probably don't know enough about it. And so I would imagine that's why it's not being pushed to the front of the agenda. I mean, I'd love a bit of testosterone, I'll be honest. My libido's fine. Wow, it'd be great if it was more. But my memory, you know, brain fog is my biggest challenge, and it comes in waves. You know, I'm on HRT, but I can have a month or 2 months where my brain fog's really bad, and that's the thing. And like you said, you do it for your job. And I mean, I used to worry I was going to forget people's names. Now I forget entire section of the arts. Like, I can't remember the word for dance. So I would love testosterone. So why we're not celebrating the hope that it's just around the corner, I don't know.
Well, I'm really interested because we do know where there are testosterone receptors in our body, and they're not sitting there being receptors for nothing, are they? So we know they're in our muscles, in our vulva, in our brains, in our eyes. They're everywhere. And obviously they are doing something, you know, we could study that a bit more and work out what's going on. And I'm also really interested in the women who do maintain testosterone in later life, because it's obviously only part of it is produced by your ovaries. So when your ovaries shut down, your adrenal glands and your skin a bit as well, and your fat produces a tiny bit of testosterone. And there are these women who roll along, I think, with the testosterone into later life. And, you know, like Ruth Bader Ginsburg, you know, being on the Supreme Court in America, you know, until she died, you know, and there are these kind of super women, I think, who may well have kept up their fuel in the form of testosterone, or they just may be great. But, you know, I had none. I love having it, and it really, really helps with my sharpness. I'm very aware that I get up in the morning, I can remember stuff, I know what I'm going to do, and I can talk for an hour, you know, without notes and do a PowerPoint. And those sort of things terrified me at one point in my perimenopause, and they just don't terrify me anymore. And I must say, the other joy of the whole menopause hormone HRT thing is that every day I wake up with my hormones at the same level. I am no longer a clapped out banger. I am a Tesla. I'm absolutely steady. And I feel I can do so much more with my life and try and help other people. And, you know, it really gives you this great big platform that you sit comfortably on every morning, and you know you're not going to have horrible PMS or whatever it was. And, you know, you only realize afterwards, you know, that endless kind of roller coaster of a shit show of your periods.
Yeah.
And such a joy to not have them, but also to have your hormones at an optimum level. And it's something that's not happened to women ever on earth, really, until, you know, maybe 20, 30 years ago. And we are that generation of women who will have optimized hormones. And we are really lucky, and we've got to do something with that good health that we are getting. And you know, obviously we've got to work till we're 67 or 68 now anyway, but, you know, it's but it's an extraordinary thing when you think about it. We are a new prototype of older women that didn't exist. And people, you know, just don't understand the power of HRT, and they don't understand about it protecting you from osteoporosis and helping your bone grow. They don't understand about transdermal HRT helping with cardiovascular disease. They don't necessarily know it makes your joints less creaky. You know, they don't know it helps with type 2 diabetes. And if they did, I think we're very bad at looking into the future, but your parents have died of heart attacks, or, you know, your dad's had a hip replacement, your mum's had a hip replacement. I mean, think about it. And then, you know, you're 10 years before that, what do you need to do, you know?
I think the other really interesting thing about older women's health as well, you mentioned, you know, your mum having died of Alzheimer's, and my aunt died of dementia, and my mum has Parkinson's. So I feel like I've got this sort of double whammy of neurological things down the female side of the family. And, you know, dementia is far more prevalent in women than it is in men. And we know that HRT, or we think we know that HRT can help with that. But maybe testosterone is the key there as well. You know, maybe that's the thing. Is anyone looking into that, Kate? That's the thing. Is anyone looking into testosterone and dementia, or, you know, Alzheimer's and all of those brain diseases?
I don't think so. I don't know of any studies. I do know that Roberta Brinton in America and Lisa Moscone, who we interviewed on the program, and Lisa Moscone wrote The XX Brain about estrogen in the brain. And I asked them both about testosterone, and they were like, oh, don't know. They may be thinking about it now. But I mean, in good news about Parkinson's, that big study that Roberta Brinton did on 400,000 women's health records in America over 10 years, and whether they used HRT and what kind of HRT they used. And that showed that women who were using transdermal estrogen had a 73% less likely chance of getting Alzheimer's and dementia. And I can't remember the exact figure for Parkinson's, but it lowered the chances of Parkinson's as well. Which I think maybe does come upon women in menopause when their hormones go down. And so that was really interesting that there were other things that affected. And if you look at my grandmother died of multiple sclerosis, and although, you know, estrogen does not solve the problem of multiple sclerosis, women who have more estrogen have less chances of big relapses. And we know that women who are pregnant and have got multiple sclerosis, when they've got that tons of estrogen pumping through their body, really do much, much better. So, you know, the combination of HRT, if you are getting or you might get multiple sclerosis, is really worth, you know, looking into. Does anyone know that? Is anyone discussing that? I mean, yes, there are, you know, there are lots of people like Dr. Louise Newson who are looking into the kind of future health of women. But I think the longevity argument is our next argument. And you know, not living a slightly sick life.
Yeah. You know? So obviously you work with the menopause charity and you are this wonderful shouty menopause person. I mean that in the best possible way, and very knowledgeable and very researched. What are we on the brink of? What's about to pivot, do you think?
I think I've been talking to Alzheimer's research in the UK, and they are really interested in the effect of estrogen in the brain and whether there are going to be some studies on that. And I think if we could do our own local studies, now again, it's almost 20 years for the, you know, for that sort of thing to show, but you can certainly show in brain scans over a number of years how brains are changing. So I'm really interested in that kind of as a child of Alzheimer's, and also in menopause. From perimenopause to menopause, your amyloid plaques, which can often be a precursor to Alzheimer's, start to form more heavily. So, you know, if you're someone like me and has been looking at Alzheimer's thinking, oh God, I'm going to get it. I don't know what I'm going to do. The idea that there is some way in which you can protect your brain, and yes, you may get it, and yes, you carry the gene, but you can really protect yourself by, you know, exercise, eating well, and, you know, estrogen. And I think that's really, really exciting that, you know, the two thirds of women who presently get Alzheimer's and dementia, you know, they're two thirds of the patients in Britain, that may not need to happen, you know. And I just know, having looked after my mum, that, you know, it's not just the person that has Alzheimer's, it's everyone around them, you know. And it's a long, long, painful, you know, disengagement. And, you know, I wouldn't wish that on anyone, but, you know, so many people, it's one in five, I think, isn't it? People get Alzheimer's. So, you know, anything we can do around that, I'm excited about that. What I think is going to happen.
Kate is pointing her pen at the screen now, which I really love. It's like, and another thing, like what I think is going to happen. Go on,
well,
go on, Kate.
I think there's a couple of things. There are pockets of the NHS where there are wonderful people doing wonderful menopause programs, thinking about it. And then there are sort of, there's a bureaucracy at the top, not quite paying attention. And I think it may come from sort of, you know, nurses and people up. There might be a really, really strong movement that way. The other thing I've seen, because in order to finance the work I do and the documentaries I do, I don't, you know, because you don't really make any money trying to put out a documentary for a year. So what I do is I give speeches to big companies, not drug companies, but things like Deloitte or banks or, you know, councils, about the menopause and kind of raise awareness. And I'm really aware that the private sector is absolutely on this in a really smart way. And lots of them are not just putting out a menopause policy. They're saying, our private health insurance at this bank must include menopause. Or they're saying, we need to give anyone who wants to a day off to go and see their doctor for menopause, you know. And they are looking at the medical aspect as well as the kind of cultural and social aspect in their companies. And I do like going in and just getting in there and saying, right, male execs, we're going to talk about driver giants. and what vaginal estrogen can do for you and your company, you know. And they go, oh my God, you know, and also I think men are fantastic about this. They are absolutely keen to have partners, to have sisters, to have colleagues that are happy and fully functioning and enjoying their lives. And when they hear the science, they're like, oh, okay, this is absolutely clear to me. One in 10 of my workers do not need to leave if I spend a tiny bit of money and just be a bit more humane about what they're having to deal with. It's clear to me that the private sector is like, thought it through and realised the economics, but the public sector has not. I don't understand why.
Well, hopefully it's going to start catching up, but it is good to hear that these big companies that you're speaking to are sort of making their own changes. And also there's quite a lot of tech coming out around menopause, isn't there? I think there is a bit of a pincer movement from several directions, which is good to hear. You look and sound the epitome of health, joy and excitement. How post-menopause are you now?
I am 58. So I had menopause at 52. But obviously I was absolutely bananas for about 5 years before that. But I didn't know. But I have to always say at this point, I always like to talk about anger in perimenopause. I like to get it in. And I always remember the things I threw in perimenopause before I knew I was menopausal. And I had three children, you know, the sick mum, the full-time job, you know, just trying to keep everything in the air. And I threw against the kitchen wall, blue poster paint, broccoli, an entire butternut squash, a butter dish that broke with all the bits of china in the butter, and a copy of Nigella's Christmas against the wall at different times.
I was going to say, that wasn't all on one day, was it?
But I was aware of that mad rage that overtook me. And I am not, I mean, I might be angry about menopause, but I am not an angry person in a kind of personal way at all. In fact, I'm quite relaxed. And I was possessed by the devil. And I realized the devil was the lack of hormones or the leaping hormones at that point. I don't even know. I suppose it was lack of progesterone, that sort of calming hormone, and then little, got really angry. I'm very aware I've sort of been in some way humbled by the fact that I couldn't control everything. And it really teaches you what it's like to not be able to control your own health and your own mental health. And I hadn't, you know, in that way of just getting on with it, I hadn't been aware of that before. And I think it makes you more sympathetic to what everyone else is going through. And the more you talk about your own stupid things you've done, the better it feels for everyone else, I think, you know. Did you do anything appalling?
I don't think I did anything appalling. I mean, I got terrible driving anxiety, and I hired a car in France once and I took it back to the hire place at the airport. I got on the plane and I was checking my emails before we took off, and I had an email from the hire car company saying, you need to fill a form in for the accident you had. And I immediately thought, I've obviously had an accident, didn't notice. I didn't think they've made a mistake. I was so anxious about driving. I was like, well, that's it. I've obviously had a crash in France, not noticed, you know, because I'm an idiot. I didn't know I was perimenopausal. I just accepted that. And I like emailed back and said, well, I don't know, where's the damage? It turned out to be a mistake. And I think that was like the stupidest thing ever. Just the obvious explanation was that I had an accident and didn't notice, rather than they've made a mistake. Some of my worst perimenopausal moments were just awful period floods. You know, I flooded almost an entire campsite in Croatia and had to, use the campsite owner's washing machine. It was like a complete blood bath and, you know, awful places to try and be leading my best middle-aged kids have left home life. And I was trailing around with these horrendous periods. But it is important to say to women, there is so much wonderful life the other side of this hump.
Yeah, I always say, you know, it shouldn't be about misery. It's about metamorphosis. And what we have to say is it does take a lot of changing. And HRT, we know, is takes a while to get settled down, get it right for you. You've often got to go back and have a fight with your doctor or ask for more help. But once you've got that, it is really good. I feel so kind of sorry in a way. And I feel terrible that, you know, the 1 in 7 women who get breast cancer or who are scared of HRT for various reasons are not being allowed to kind of have this. And I have been doing stuff, like I did some tests with friends on really, really high grade CBD oil, two friends that had had breast cancer, and it really helped them with their hot flushes and it really helped them with sleeping. But I think we really need to sort of pray that the science will come through for those people. And also the very interesting new studies on breast cancer and testosterone, which are coming out of America. But again, they're observational. You know, and nobody's going to do that study because, you know, there's a risk of them dying of breast cancer because, you know, breast cancer comes back. And it's a really difficult medical area to do research in. But yet again, women are quietly going out there and finding out for themselves. There's a fantastic doctor in Glasgow, actually, called Dr. Alison Macbeth, who has a clinic for women who've had breast cancer and then does their menopause afterwards and helps them with all the symptoms in as many ways as she can, including some HRT for some kinds of breast cancer. But I think it's such a large number of women and they're just being left. And I'm aware of that kind of pain and difficulty.
Well, thankfully, with you on the case, Kate Muir, you're rattling some cages and shaking things up and hopefully helping to make a huge change. And for anyone who doesn't know, Kate's book, Everything You Need to Know About the Menopause But We're Too Afraid to Ask, is available and full of all sorts of wonderful information and consoling facts as well, I think it's fair to say. It's like one of those things that makes you go, oh, phew, I feel so much better now I've read this. So thank you so much. Briefly before you go, Kate, is there going to be any more Davina?
Yes, we are shooting another women's health documentary right now. Can't reveal exactly what it is. And I am doing another book. So yeah, there's going to be a lot more revolution coming from that direction.
Fantastic stuff. Thank you so much, Kate Muir, for being on My Last Eggs.
Thank you.
Thanks to Kate Muir for kicking off season 3 for us. You can follow On My Last Eggs with new episodes released every Wednesday from Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can also find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Do send a message. We'd love to hear from you. Have a great week.